from Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Expressive, Minneapolis. This is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are Lydia is an artist, which is just a statement, and platforms and ecosystems. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
You have feedback on how we're naming these topics, Stephen?
Yeah, I got to put them in the script. And sometimes we get a little loosey-goosey.
Nice games at club/feedback.
Tell Stephen why he's right.
Some fun stuff happened lately to me. I saw probably my favorite currently working band, The Beths, which I have talked about on this program before. Mm-hmm. They put out an album a while back, which I was just completely head over heels for, and I talked about it on the show. They just put out their follow-up to it, which I was like, okay, it's fine, but, you know, it's nothing's going to top Expert in a Dying Field.
Sure.
And then I just listened to it 100 times in a row. Now it's my favorite. It's called The Straight Line Was a Lie. It's a very sad record.
Oh, really?
Say. Okay. It's a high-energy record, but when you, really sit with it, I'm not selling it very well, but it's an incredible rock and roll record from The Beths. And I saw them. They came to town. They're a New Zealand band. Mm. And then a friend of the show, Sam Baseman, her and her partner came with me and Dale.
Oh, fun.
We went out to dinner.
Yeah.
We saw the show together. It was quite nice. It was a good evening.
Aww.
Can I admit something? Mm. When I saw in the notes that Mark saw The Beths,
yeah,
I thought that you meant you saw Beth Korth and her husband.
Right.
In my brain, the Beths equaled the Korths.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, great. That's awesome. Must have been something cool they did.
Right. Beth Korth and Andy Beth.
So. Yeah.
Also friends of the show.
Yeah.
No, that did not happen. But the other thing that happened to me is, and I don't know if you can hear my voice, but I'm sick again.
Oh, no.
I think I talk about this on the show quite often because I'm quite often sick.
Yeah.
But I'm in that point where I'm just coughing all the time. I've got a mask on today here in the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. I don't believe I'm contagious, but you never know.
No. And if Mark's audio sounds a little muffled, that's why. If my audio sounds muffled, I'm also wearing a mask because I'm going to be going home to Massachusetts with some very immunocompromised people. And mm-hmm. I don't want them to get sick because right. they will be sick for a very long time as well. Just passing around that love.
Yeah, yeah. But it's flu season.
Yeah.
I just got a flu shot, too, which is the weirdest thing.
Oh, that sucks.
But that's my way of transitioning. There's, end of year things are happening.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, this is, dear listener, I'm sure you're thinking about, what's left on your checklist before, whatever celebrations or whatever days off of work or whatever. The end of the year, even if your routine doesn't change that much, it has, a quality,
mm-hmm.
Which was sort of, there's a little bit of a rush to prepare for it in a sense, even if there's not much on, and this is obviously different person to person, but we're doing that here in the game dev community. We have a holiday party coming up pretty soon.
True.
I think it will have happened by the time this episode comes out, where we're going to do a lot of what we're going to do in our episode next week, which is our last of the year, our nicest episode, where we talk about the year past.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So on my mind is a lot of reflecting and cataloging, what did we do? How much progress did we make? What's happening next? Mm-hmm. I suspect that's true for a lot of listeners as well.
Yeah. I guess I haven't talked about my class that I've been taking this semester.
Mm-hmm.
My class will end, in a few weeks. Actually, or one of our final project things that we're supposed to do a presentation, is on the same day as the holiday party. So I got to do that, then immediately go to the holiday.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I got to do that, then I got to pick up my brother, and then immediately go to the
holiday.
Okay,
but you're still going.
It's 100 miles of driving.
It's annoying.
Well, I'm glad I still get to see you.
Yeah, yeah, I'm still going.
Yeah.
But my class, I've been taking a UX class,
mm-hmm.
And that has been interesting because it's a lot of stuff that I know, but it's just more formalized.
Yeah.
Language for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as I'm me, I tend to think about it in terms of games, but it's interesting. We're doing it for a website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that website changed dramatically, or will be changing dramatically in the next few weeks, which is really annoying because we tested the first version. So we got to talk about that.
And make you take out all the blank tags.
Yeah. It's just annoying. So that it'll be a whole thing. But I'm looking forward to getting that, to working on that too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, it's the end of the year stuff. So I have to think about like what I'm going to do next year with respect to like what classes I want to take.
Yeah.
I'm getting close to graduating.
Yeah.
Finally.
How's that like progress? Cause you know, you've been taking your time with it.
Yeah.
Because you're a working man. Mm. As you get closer, is it just a matter of like certain things you have to take or just building up the amount of credits?
It's mostly just credits at this point. I think I have all of the accumulated things I need to take.
Yeah.
Like all your degree requirements.
Right. Yeah. My degree is weird. Cause like I got to build my curriculum.
Oh.
So it's not like, you know, an engineering degree where like, you know what you need to get.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had to determine what I needed to get. And there's like requirements based off of what I picked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did.
Yeah, that's right. You did do that. I forgot. Yeah. So I've been doing that for quite some time, and I did all like I made sure that I had all of the things, and I think I have all of the requirements set up. But it's just you need a certain amount of credits. Mm-hmm. And
are you gonna do a capstone? When I was doing that program, and I think the program you're doing is different from the one I did.
It is. Yeah.
It's spiritually very similar.
Yes.
But that had ended up in a 2-credit class that was just a project that was self-directed.
Yeah.
Do you have something like that?
I did have
a final paper or a final thing or something.
I did have to take a class. That was like it was like a 1-credit class, 1 semester, where I just like learned about the program itself.
Yeah.
But I did that years ago. Okay. That's the only thing I think I have to do.
Really?
So yeah.
Oh.
I don't have any capstones or anything like that, as far as I know.
Huh.
So as long as I have the credits and stuff, I can just
walk. I mean that's better for how you're doing it because like. It made a lot when I was doing that. It made a lot of sense because I was in the school environment,
right?
And I think it would be harder to do for me now,
yeah,
to have like a project that was also a class and had an advisor stuff when I wasn't already like completely immersed in the college experience.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm pleased you don't have to adapt to that format.
I mean, me too.
I mean, apart from the fact that you just got to do whatever and you'll get tick up until you get enough and you're good. Well,
I don't know if this is exactly the same. I mean, I imagine it's not. But like, so in at Carleton, we call our final capstone projects comps, short for composition, because not everybody has to write a paper. So if you're an art major, that your comps could be an art show. If you're a theater major, it could be a performance. If you're a CAMS major, it could be like a film or it could be a paper.
You have
like
to compose some artifact.
Yeah. So like I wrote a really long paper, but like logistically we had the comps as the only like 400 level class. And it was literally part of it was literally to say like, hey, 6 out of your 18 credits for the term is you doing your comps, essentially just to like stake that claim. So that way you couldn't like take too much stuff because you were supposed to be working on that.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So even if like we did, each major did also have like their own structure of like advisors and peer review and stuff like that. That was, on paper, it was literally like, okay, 6 credits this term, you're doing your comps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have to do any of that, thankfully. Because that would be a lot. Nah.
So do you know what, question one, how many credits you got left? Or rather, how many classes do you have left? And 2, do you know what you're going to be, what courses you'll be taking until you're the end?
I don't know what courses I'll be taking because I didn't figure that out yet.
Okay.
I'm supposed to, because I could sign up for classes now. but I tend to be last minute on that, and it's not the best practice, but it's worked out okay so far. So I haven't been punished.
Yeah. You're throwing stones into the pile now. It doesn't really matter. You've done all your requirements.
That's kind of why I haven't.
So it's okay to do it last minute. Mm-hmm. But you know, you want to pick good stuff, get the best out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's only like 2 or 3 classes left. So like I'll be done in a year or so.
Cool. Nice. Because you're kind of just doing 1 per semester for now. Yeah, it's a pretty, that's like a healthy pace.
Yeah, it's been slow, but like that's the, you know, it makes sure that I'm able to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Neat.
Well, fill us all in when we get back from hiatus. What you've picked. You better have picked something by then.
Oh, I'll have to, yeah. I'll be halfway through that class.
Yeah.
Yeah. My fun thing is I'm getting occupational therapy for my hands.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, my hands have on and off been hurting because of activity and because of the weather for the last, like, 5 years. Oh. So every year I'd be like, hey, primary care physician, my hands, they occasionally hurt. And it's not been a problem. And like nowadays, like one of the things I have is that like my hand joints feel a little stiff or have pressure right before it rains.
Oh, sure.
There was one time actually where there wasn't rain in the forecast, and then in my hand, I woke up and my hands felt that way, and then later it rained. I was like, but I also definitely have I have been feeling some weird stuff in my left thumb, and it's indirect enough that I can't tell exactly what I'm doing. It's not like if I do this, this happens, and therefore it's like, oh, don't do this.
Yeah.
And because, like, I use my hands for literally everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I need my hands.
As a human being.
Well, also because, like, if I'm not busy with something, I go nuts.
Yeah, sure.
And everything, every hobby I have and my work is all done with my hands in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm like, I pulled the trigger. I'm like, hey, well, we need to do something about this now. So, I got some x-rays. Don't have arthritis yet.
Okay. Good.
And I'm going to start, I made a schedule today, my first OT appointment.
Okay.
I'm really curious at how that's going to intersect with gaming and with my work, because I use a keyboard every day. I play games every day. I use my phone to play games and to do things every day. And especially, like, I'm curious what it's going to be, what it actually is going to entail.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also curious, like, if I will get to use some of the cool accommodations and stuff that I've, you know, Ellen and I saw at Serious Play, or that I've heard about,
sure,
you know, or what exactly is, can I change about my setup that will then be kinder to my hands?
The ergonomics rabbit hole.
Yeah. I mean, the part of it is, like, I know it's very accessible, literally, like, you can go and find the files for 3D printing and then pop things on your joystick to make it easier for you to use them, depending on what you have, what you don't have, mm-hmm. whatever. But because I don't know what exactly would be helpful, I haven't pursued that. And I have a friend with a 3D printer who's always willing to print me stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm really interested. I'm excited to, one, like, hopefully safeguard my hands for the next however many years of my life. Mm-hmm. And also just kind of get a more personal foray into something that I knew at some point I was going to, you know, kind of get hands-on experience with.
Sure.
Well, I will. This is a public service announcement for listeners, but also for you, Lydia. The American with Disabilities Act requires businesses, once they reach a certain size, and it's not a very high threshold, to provide ergonomic accommodations for folks. It's one of the reasons why the ADA is one of the greatest civil rights legislation in history, is because it helps so many people who otherwise would have to struggle to get assistance.
Yeah.
So for folks who, like, you know, need to get, like, ergonomic keyboards or mm-hmm. special chairs, like, you know, your company has to pay for that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like, Ian doesn't have anything diagnosed yet, but Ian was able to get a split keyboard through their company because it is ergonomically better. So that way, you know, and that helps with back and shoulder pain.
Right. Yeah.
Things like a lumbar support for your chair is the type of thing that or a wrist rest to be able to use your mouse. That's the type of stuff that, even if you don't have something like on paper, you can ask your company and you could probably get it.
Yeah. And if you feel like, oh, I only need like $40 worth of stuff, like, that's not much, like, make your company pay for it.
Yeah. If anything, like, that's going to be more the type of stuff they'd be willing to pay for, because it's only $40.
Yeah.
Because
you have the right to have those that support it.
Right. For sure.
Right.
That's good to know, because I didn't know that. Yeah. I'm glad y'all know.
Yeah.
Now, if you work from home or you're a freelancer, like I've been most of my career, you gotta figure that out yourself.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
take advantage of that office stipend if you ever get it from someplace.
Yes,
that's how I got my crazy split keyboard.
Yeah,
I spend my entire office stipend on that.
All right, so what's all this nonsense about Lydia not being an artist?
Yeah, so
can we settle this question?
Yeah.
Well, this is part the third of giving Lydia therapy after I went to Chicago. The Tell Lydia She's Wrong edition, because in previous episode, I mentioned that part of, you know, why I gave my topic to Mark, which Steven said was cheating, was because,
it was cheating, but I still got points.
Was that, it's because I agree that I do art. Mm-hmm. I help make things that are art, that I agree are art, but I don't feel comfortable calling myself an artist.
Yeah.
And y'all were like, we need to put a pin on that and revisit it, because you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is going to be a little bit more of, like, open antagonistic forum, I guess. But I've compiled a list of things that I do/have done that is art, and I agree unequivocally is art.
Mm-hmm.
And then a list of things I feel more comfortable calling myself that is not artist, And then I figure y'all can just go from there.
Okay.
Have a free for all.
Sure.
All right.
So things I do or have done that is art, video games. I make games.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm a designer. Dance. So I've done extensive performance and also some choreography and improv. I've been in some really weird stuff, which we can go into if that's relevant. But I've done some really, really cool stuff and worked with people who I would say are some of the coolest artists I've gotten to work with ever.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, they're not like, I mean, I guess I did work with a famous choreographer. That was not my favorite project to work with. but the students that I worked with are just so, so cool. And I hope they're still working on and making cool art. Fiber arts. So knitting, sewing, crocheting, anything with needles, pretty much I've done slash do. Mm-hmm. I literally have knitting in my bag right now. General crafting. I've done some prop making for the escape room, but also general hodgepodge making of stuff. I've made some things for our D&D table, both useful things as well as like general props. I just make stuff for funsies. I've made, I did some cosplay when I was in high school and middle and high school. And I've made, like, if you ever watch Soul Eater, I made Maka Albarn's scythe and I made it to scale. It's not well made, but it is to scale and it is pretty accurate for whatever it was made of. And then I make dev assets sometimes. I've done art for games that either was like, hey, it's a game I made by myself for a class and therefore it is my stuff, or hey, we need assets and we're not going to get assets in who knows when, so I'm going to make some decent looking dev assets. And the devs actually say that I make some pretty good stuff, which is very flattering of them, because I'm definitely not an illustrator, I will say.
Sure.
So hence I am a designer. I really like vibe with being called a maker, a crafter, a dancer, and I've come to accept developer, because you know there was a while where I didn't have any dev experience, like hands-on, like I have done code, I have done this. And so that I was able to get over of being okay with calling myself a developer. But I don't really call myself an artist. I feel like I'm not. And well, I don't know why.
I don't think that you're unique in that way.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, I oftentimes, I kind of insist on calling myself an artist, at least to myself and other people, because part of it is because like the way we use the term artist in games is confusing, because we also use it to
describe
the people who draw things.
Yeah.
But I also think that like ultimately, if you're making art, you're just trying to express an idea or something, yourself, what have you. And I think that like that's kind of the only thing in my mind, as long as you are trying to express something yourself, that's all that should determine whether or not this thing is art. Mm. I mean, it's not an actual definition. I guess there's a section of the feedback form if you think I'm wrong, but that's how I define it.
Yeah.
So like, I think you are making a lot of things.
Yeah.
Thus, and you're trying to express yourself due to that. And so I would describe you as an artist.
Well, I think there's also, you've touched on the fact that like there is what you call yourself to people outside.
Right.
And then there's what you call yourself interiorly.
Yeah.
Like how you refer to yourself to other people is one thing. But and like I, for the reasons why like I wouldn't go to GDC and say I'm an artist, because I am, my trade is design.
True.
That is what I do.
But like if you were to meet somebody new at like professional event that wasn't necessarily games related, you wouldn't necessarily say that you were an artist, because like, that doesn't
almost nobody would actually say that in a meeting.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
You'd use, you know, what your skills are, what your trade is, even if it's many or multiple or mixed up.
Yeah, because you'd be like, oh, I'm a sculptor, I'm an illustrator.
Right.
But like, so there it's like, you know, there's that outward term for yourself that you use.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with not being called an artist for that because of logistical reasons.
Yeah.
But internally, it just feels kind of just feels kind of weird. It doesn't feel like something I can claim.
Sure.
Because like that, I think it's actually kind of cool that you basically put on the uncomfortable thing every so often to try and get yourself to feel like it's less uncomfortable. Yeah. I think that's that. Like, there's a lot of things that reminds me of, and I think that's kind of neat. Mm-hmm.
Well, I had to do that because I used to call myself, I think, Mark, you tried to convince me out of doing this. I used to call myself a budding game designer.
Just
calling myself a game designer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was like a big movement, but like a movement, at least in the area and like online a bit too, that like, people would be like, stop putting that in your,
yeah, no aspiring in your
right
or whatever.
If you're doing it, then you are this.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of why I put that mindset in my head too, with respect to artists.
It's definitely, I don't know if you've had to do that. I've had to learn that. I feel like as someone who grew up socially as a woman, it's very easy to fall into the like apologizing and qualifying before you present yourself kind of thing. I do that a lot in other ways.
And I do that all the time.
I think a lot that's of that, I mean, for everybody, it's in the context of like seeking validation.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so you don't, so when you, if you withhold and you pull back from making claims about what you are, what you can do, then you don't require validation.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that timidness, I think. I think for...
Yeah, you can't be disappointed.
Yeah. Speaking for myself on that topic, I think like I've always been really cavalier about just like, I don't have any problem claiming to be an artist at any point in my career.
Sure.
Maybe it's been easier for me because I've never sought validation. I've always just like, I decided you can think whatever you want.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's like a different mindset that I think is harder for people if they are, especially if you are trained in one field that has its own set of weights on it. Because I've always been kind of autodidactic and all over the place, I've never, I'm also not comfortable being called a programmer.
Sure.
Like, because it's like, I don't want that to be, I don't want to be pigeonholed into any of the things I'm good at.
Yeah.
I'm none of those things really. Mm. Like, I would rather just say I'm a developer because that's broad.
Yeah.
Or I conceptually I'm an artist and then I can describe in detail, but you don't want to hear it. It's boring. Like, you know, but, when I'm on a project and or being referred to by someone else as like, oh, this is a someone who's doing programming, and I'm like, blah, 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 blah. Mm. Oh, that's not that's reductive. Thank you. You know, so I kind of have the opposite problem in that sense. But I think it's very similar, where you sort of take on the responsibility of what that means, culturally and socially.
Right.
And so, like, I mean, to just dispel it on, in a sort of a logic sense, like Lydia, I don't think you would argue, but feel free to. Design, there's an art to design.
Yeah.
So, I mean, case closed.
Well, no, I agree that you two are right.
Yeah.
I think the thing that...
No, that, I know you know that. Yeah. And I think, so we're not really talking about that level of proving the whether you are an artist or not in a on paper technical sense.
Yes.
Because, and it's really irrelevant whether that's even true or not. It's more of just like, do you want to adopt that as an identity?
Yeah, I guess that's also why I like started with all the other things I do, because even if you did want to go and in the comments and fight Mark about this, like I have like, okay, well maybe not this thing, but here's the other stuff that maybe is more obviously art that I have done.
Yeah,
you know, because that's also very true.
Right.
You know,
right,
I have
right.
a body of work all over the place. I guess it's interesting because it's then. Also, there is like a weightiness. I almost wonder in some cases if it's also a sense of, for me at least, like a shying back from egotism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the sense of like, I can't tell if it's this either. Who am I? I can't tell if it's either who am I to say that I make something with that says something that profound with meaning, sure. or like that's saturated with meaning that it is art, or if it is my stuff good enough or meaningful enough, full of meaning enough that it can be considered art. I can't tell which one of those it is from, but I think one comes from a distaste for egotism.
Sure.
And one is a comes from a supreme lack of self-confidence, which is why I'm in therapy.
I mean, same.
But I think it's also because there is, even if, regardless of what you do, there is also the sense of like the artiste.
Yeah.
You know, sure. like, are you La Boheme, you know, on doing all the things? I don't know. There's that sense too of like, you think of like who is like the art student. It conjures a mind both of someone who looks a certain way, behaves a certain way, thinks a certain way.
Yeah.
That's... Do you claim that?
Sure.
Or do you think that what you make is would come from someone you think of that, I guess.
What you're describing sounds to me like imposter syndrome.
Yes.
So stop that.
I think that's true, but there's another dimension to it. So I used to work in what was called the creative fields.
Oh, okay.
Where, you know, I did commercial video, I did graphic design. at work, nobody would say what they were doing was art.
Sure.
Even though, like, and, you know, I think everyone knows this, but the technical bar is so incredibly low for something being art that it becomes essentially meaningless.
Yeah.
So I think there's a step on top of that. Like, we all, yes, we're all artists, quote unquote, mm-hmm. but am I an artist, right? Like, it's a step in definition. And so, like, certainly when, you know, you're designing a web page for a corporate client, you're like, I'm being creative.
Yeah.
But, like, what I'm doing is not art, and my intention are not artistic, even though in a technical sense, at every corner and every stage, it is.
Yeah, it's like the bar is on, like, the bar is very low for what is art, but there's this secret door where if you are art, then that's where...
And I don't necessarily mean this entirely in a psychological, like, we can't really bring ourselves to call it that, but there's a practical...
Yeah.
There's a practical use to splitting these definitions, right?
Yeah.
Which is why, a lot of people in those fields are called creatives. I mean, it's honestly why, like, YouTubers are called creators and not filmmakers. Right? Because it's like it has enough of a distinction in a practical sense, even if it has some level of disrespect inherent, you know, to some degree, or perhaps like, there are certainly a lot of people who aspire to be a creator because of what it means socially. They have no interest in becoming a filmmaker.
Right.
Like, it's a different context for, like, what it means.
And it's also, like, are you paying more attention to the medium or to the content, and the medium is a vehicle for that,
I think.
Because there's a lot of people on YouTube who do, like, short films and very much lean into the part of the medium that you would identify more as, like, filmmaking.
Yeah.
And then there are people who become extremely skilled technically in filmmaking because that is in service of whatever else that they are using the film to convey.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I think the psychological component of the term artist can, if you sift away all of the technical definitions, there's a kind of like an apprehension to say you're an artist is not just because of what you do or quality level or whatever, like as you're describing, Lydia, but there's also the responsibility of being an artist, right? It's not that, like, I'm scared no one will accept me if I call myself that. It's like, well, what I'm doing doesn't have maybe enough intention or purpose or statement that I wouldn't. And so it's a lot of it is, so I think imposter syndrome is part of it, but I think part of it is a self-assessment.
Yeah, okay.
Of either thinking that is something somebody else does or what I'm doing, I haven't thought enough about it through that lens.
Yeah. There's like, is it there? Which is what you're talking about. And then there's the imposter syndrome of, is it good enough? And those are two sides.
Yeah.
You can have both, but you could also have one, but not the other.
I see.
Yeah.
That's a good point. It's not exactly something I had considered. So that does clarify it. I think that, like, I mean, I see your point, because you're right. Like, there should be a distinction between, you know, corporate stuff you're doing for the purposes of selling to Best Buy or whatever, versus like trying to make a statement.
Yeah, it's whose brief are you fulfilling?
Yeah,
right. Are you doing a job and doing it in a very creative, artistic way? Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, or are you serving your own intention?
Yeah.
And both of those are incredibly valid. Like, the products resulting from it are, one is not better than the other.
Yeah.
Right. In a fully abstracted sense.
Yeah.
It's just that who is the one doing the expressiveness, the expressing, and that's the artist, right? In a sense. I think there's definitely a good test for that you'll see from a lot of, game developers is every good idea they have, they'll implement and then that's fine. But then they start saying no to good ideas. And then that there's more intention behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's more of an artistic approach, which isn't to say that at some point they became an artist. They sort of were from jump, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But again, the bar is low. It's meaningless in a sense, but it can be helpful to think of, like, are you thinking of it through the lens of art rather than through the lens of craft?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
And to say that those two lenses have different purposes.
Right.
And different practical applications and different times and places.
Yeah. Just because you're making something doesn't necessarily mean you're trying to express an idea by making it. You might just want to make a thing, like, you want a hat, you know, like, it's cold outside.
Yeah.
Well,
I would also say the bar for whether you're expressing is also a pretty low bar.
True. I agree with that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's about choices. Are you making the choices?
Yeah.
And are you making the choices for any reason? Mm-hmm. And that reason can be because it's neat.
Yeah.
That's still an artistic intent.
Yeah. Right?
I think people do get kind of caught up in this, like, what am I trying to say? And it's like, it's no more art or less art if what you're trying to say is more or less interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like, I this also, I think, kind of goes into the whole idea of like, what is fine art versus what is craft, which is very fraught and very like an interesting history. And I don't have enough knowledge or time to go into it. But like, that's why a lot of things that are traditionally like women's work, you know, are not considered art, but crafts. That's why fiber artists are calling them, trying to call themselves fiber artists more.
Ah. It's why film editors are still, more women are film editors than any other field in filmmaking.
Yeah.
Because it was stitching.
Right, right.
And it was given to women. It wasn't seen as artistic. It was seen as craft.
Labor,
And that cultural bias, even though it's essentially gone from culture, the weight of it still has an effect today.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't, no one would describe film editing as anything but an artistic pursuit.
Yeah.
Right.
You know.
I guess maybe as like, as an exercise, I actually have a hat that I made.
Yeah.
It is a nice hat. And I guess the intentionality in it was I wanted to try, or this was the second of a pattern that I really enjoyed knitting and I wanted to make something out of it. The yarn was, I really loved how soft it was. I loved the color. I ended up really loving just the texture and the smell while I was working with it. It's very nice and plush and it's very fine and clean stitching. Like it shows the stitches well. And then I added safety pins, which are in the Roman numerals for 22 as a reference to the female main character in Persona 3 Portable who has bobby pins with 22 in the shape of 22, which is in itself a reference to the 22nd of Major Arcana in a tarot deck, which is the world, which if you play Persona, you know the tarot deck matters a lot. So like, I guess if in terms of intentionality, there is intentionality of adornment. There's intentionality of like, I want to make this thing because I need and want a hat. And then there's like intentionality of the material and working with the material and enjoying that process.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's nice. You won't feel it.
It is soft.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you wore it. I did wear it.
That's right. Yeah, I remember it being very soft.
So yeah, I guess, yeah. I don't know if I will have a point where like, I think in the term of validation and you want like the stamp of like, yes, you have validation or like diagnosis almost of like, yes, you are this thing. I do wonder at what point we'll be like, you must be this tall to consider yourself an artist. You must have done this thing or this much. Yeah. Maybe I'll find that.
I think context is really important here where I think you might be feeling because around this table, we talk about it a lot, but you might be feeling, I don't consider myself that. So is that a problem? And as much as I very much want you to consider yourself an artist, I don't necessarily think it's a problem if you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of agree.
In terms of the work that you do, right?
I think I more have a problem with it fundamentally because it is a contradiction within myself that I so heartily believe that to be true outside of myself, and yet I disagree with it internally.
Sure.
And in order to fully and unabashedly agree with it outside of myself, I should, by logic, agree with that within myself, even if it's not something I claim every day.
Yeah, I think that sometimes you had brought this up a little bit too, Mark, that like sometimes when you adapt the label of artist that says something about yourself and you don't necessarily want to misconstrue who you are as a person to other people, because it is a form of communication.
Yeah.
So if you call yourself an artist, people might get maybe the wrong idea of you in a way that you would potentially want to avoid. At least as I think about that in my head all the time.
Is that different with artistic versus creative? Because I would agree that I'm creative. I would not necessarily say I'm artistic. That still feels a little icky.
Sure.
But I think that because if someone said I'm an artist and you're like, well, what do you art? art?
Yeah.
Then there's that like present yourself
art?
Thing.
What are you art?
But if you say, oh, I'm artistic, then it's looser, I think, in that same way. Like I think someone would say like, oh yeah, you are a pretty artistic person based on the criteria I've mentioned previously, but it's adjacent enough that it's still something I don't necessarily, I would have to try it on a lot.
It's interesting because I would definitely describe myself as an artist, but I would not describe myself as artistic.
I'm going to cut you both off on that because I think the term artistic it's not an archaic term exactly, but I think you guys are both also responding to the fact that it nobody uses that word very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think people use creative much more to mean that same thing. Hmm. So I think when you think of like all the words that I could use, and you're like, well, that one doesn't sound right. I think a lot of it is just because it's a hoity-toity word in the way that artist isn't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think you might be responding more to that than what it actually literally does imply.
That's probably
to a degree anyway. Because I don't think, and then like, when do I describe myself as artistic? And I'm like, never.
Which is
like,
weird, because I would feel more comfortable putting on the hoity-toity word than saying I'm an artist.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's wild. Okay.
Like between the two, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know, because it's, I or maybe it's just because it's the presenting thing. I don't know. It still feels kind of gross.
It might just be a sound thing. Like, it might, maybe the word artist doesn't feel right to you, but artistic does.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's considered a victory in my book, so.
I don't know. Well, we'll see.
More to unpack.
Yeah.
Nice listeners, have you ever reflected on what you do and how you refer to yourself? Like, did you ever realize that you've been an aspiring video game maker for the last 3 years?
Right.
Is that something?
Has that changed the way you work, right?
Yeah.
Because this is why I always want people to consider themselves artists when they do this kind of thing. It focuses you.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think it's not the only way to work.
Yeah.
But I think when you think of yourself as that, then you start thinking about, well, do I actually, like, what do I need to do to express what I want to express? Mm-hmm. And that might mean really learn C++.
Sure.
Right. But like, it's a driver, a motivator.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that, like, when we think about game design, we want character actions to be motivated. We think about narratives. We want story beats to be motivated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, those are all, and I think in terms of your working, creating design pillars and like, how you're putting together a project, but also how you're adapting, learning new skills. And if the reason you're doing it is to express what you want to express. Yeah. I think that lens is very useful to help you decide what to do next.
Yeah.
And so I always encourage people to think of themselves in that way, because it really clarifies, like, it's actually not that important that you're the best in the world at this 3D modeling software. Mm. Unless that is your goal. Mm. If that's your goal, go nuts.
Yeah.
But if your goal is, I'm doing this so I can do this other thing, how well do I need to learn this? What tools do I need? How fast do I need to be at this in order to achieve that? It can drive you to become better at what you're doing, but not to compartmentalize all your skills and focus on them for their own sake.
Yeah.
Because if you're an artist, then none of the other stuff matters. Those are all just tools to get you to what being an artist is.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's nice, because there is a lot of emphasis on doing it right. I mean, we did have the previous episode early with, like, do you do it right or do you do it?
Yeah.
And how do you know when? That's a really actually a good way to frame that.
And part of why I sort of have a framework for this is because I am a type of person who wants to do it right.
Mm. Yeah.
I will obsess over the things that no one's going to care about and aren't actually that important. So I actually, I need to have that lens to stop me from, like, just spinning my wheel.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You spin out completely. I get paralyzed before I can do anything.
Yeah.
For those same reasons, because then it's like, okay, but because then it goes into the peril of executive functioning of okay, what do I do first? How do I do it? How do I break it down? And then your to-do list becomes 10 things long.
Yeah.
But you wanted to do another thing. You know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And like, it's important to really, because like, it's a production skill to like know what you literally need to do in order to do this and to get the result you want.
True.
But that can also send you into a direction of like those things for their own value.
Yeah.
When it's like, if you have a larger goal in mind, and as a game developer, if you're making something independently, that it's really easy to say, I have an artistic intent. But even if you're on a team and you're not necessarily the creative director and you don't necessarily have your intention is just in a corner, that I think it's still a useful lens.
Yes.
To focus those things because it just puts everything under one umbrella, which I think it's practical. It's a practical definition. And after all of this, I think it's a practical thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we'll revisit this, I'm sure.
Yeah. Check in with me at some point.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It is the holiday season. I am actually kind of being maybe proactive, and I have started gift giving.
Oh.
But I also know that past Lydia has been terrible at that and has probably bought gifts a little too close. So, you know, if we could send pass Lydia some ideas so that way she or anybody else who is analogous to Pass Lydia can actually get their butt together and get some cool presents for people. What are we thinking?
This is a fascinating premise, but if you have a game developer in your life, such as a Pass Lydia, you might want to get them some game dev related gifts.
Yeah.
And you can get those from us.
Yes.
Right, Steven?
Done being sly. Buy our things.
I love how just direct you've been the last.
I'm imagining a listener being like, what are they getting at? Twist.
We got, yeah.
Buy our things.
We got t-shirts. We got pillows.
Got pillow.
We got glom.
Yes. All fun things to put. You know what? They're fun stuffing. What are those called?
Stuffing stockers?
Yeah.
Stocking stuffers.
That's the word. I got us confused. But yeah, they're all nice and small. You can fit them in there.
Glom in particular is a perfect family holiday gift.
It is.
Like, I know, like, every ad says their thing is perfect, but it is.
It'll be great for your family.
Because you can open it up and then immediately play it when you are done opening up all your presents.
For that.
It takes as long to learn as it does to describe.
Yes.
Which is, I think it's a masterpiece of elegance. Mm-hmm. I'm very proud of us. Mm-hmm. Get it for your family.
Yeah, yeah.
Where might you get Glom and our associated merch items?
Nicegames.club/merch.
Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Okay, so I want to talk about some things that just been on my mind a lot lately, which is usually where I mine my topics from, which is Blippo's been out for almost 2 months.
Right.
And I am now working on a Mac port.
Okay.
In a term, okay. Maybe a little bit. And I'll get into why. But like, I've been thinking a lot about one, because it's annoying, doing a Mac port. I think all developers know this. Unless you are a native Mac user and that's your world. And even if you are, because if you're trying to distribute Mac applications, it's a hassle.
Yeah.
And I'm dealing with that now, and I'll get into a little bit, but it got me thinking a lot about how platforms really govern a lot of our behavior as developers.
Sure.
And it made me think about a lot of the news because I've also been dealing with Steam a lot, because Steam drives most of the sales for most indie games.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't mean like PC, I mean Steam specifically.
Yeah.
And I think on the show I've ranted a lot about Steam as a monopoly in a way that frustrates me, because it's not seen that way.
Yeah.
But it actually does use the levers of its monopoly to strangle competition in a way that I don't think is legal. And that's a big argument. I'm not going to make it again here. But as a developer, you can't just say, well, you know, Steam is cool, but like, I don't really like the way they do things, so I'm going to sell my game elsewhere. Yeah. Like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Like, you do not have a choice.
Yeah.
There is really no game, you know, you can't sell games without that, unless you cobble together and other things and have a huge marketing budget.
Right.
Example, from where we're sitting, a news story came out today, a game called Horses, which is sort of a gonzo horror game, got banned from Steam. And the developers, at least according to them, because they're putting out a PR campaign about it, basically to try to drum up enough attention to overcome this deficit. And sure. I don't know that it's going to work.
Yeah.
But as they tell it, they believe that Steam got the wrong idea about their game. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Steam has limits on, you know, pornographic games and stuff like that. Right. And things that they believe might have like legal implications. And supposedly this game got caught up in that. Mm. And I look at the trailer for this game and I'm like, I don't know that I'd put it on my store, but like, you know, I don't really see anything objectionable there.
Yeah.
But I could also see that maybe the developers aren't telling the whole story. But the point is that they've locked out of this ecosystem, this platform, which like shouldn't be a problem if there were 10 stores.
Yeah.
And so really just thinking about, as we make games, we think about what will Steam players like? What will the algorithms support? Mm-hmm. And that governs so much of how we think about our own artistic intent to tie the topics together. And that frustrates me a lot because I really don't want to be, I just don't want to be controlled by those things.
Sure.
And I also don't want, I mean, I think there are, you know, you have to live in the world you live in. But at the same time, I feel like there's, a lot of these things are very frustrating.
Yeah.
And that includes like on Mac, like if you want to develop for the Mac, you have to go buy a Macintosh.
Yeah.
If you want to develop for iOS, you have to buy a Macintosh. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Like these are things that are just, we kind of accept it. We grouse about them, but we don't really sit down and think that actually that's wrong.
Like, well, I don't know that we don't think that it's wrong, but we don't, it feels like we don't have a lot of control on.
Well, we definitely don't have a lot of control. Yeah. But I mean, You will talk to a lot of developers and they will be like, I can see why that is the case. Okay. People do. And so, you know, listener, I'd love to hear from you if, if you're someone who, you know, I mean, fight it out in the comments in our Discord if you like. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I get really frustrated because it reminds you how small you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that said, like the thing about Steam and about other platforms is they're supposed to give you the cost of having to follow their rules and work in their system is you get all the benefits of being part of that system.
Yeah.
But when there's only one place to go,
yeah,
then everyone's back on the same level. There's no benefits to that system.
Right.
There's only deficits for not participating in the system.
Yes.
And I think people have a hard time looking at that where they like, well, I mean, you can't make an iOS game unless you buy a Mac, which is weird, but like, you know, but what are you going to do then? It's like, you can't be on iOS and like that. It's like, great. But if there were other app stores on iOS other than the one that Apple operates, then maybe those ones you could code sign and not have to buy a Macintosh to do it.
Right.
But people don't, they just think, well, that's just, I mean, how else could you, would it possibly work?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it could work if there was more than one option for a lot of these things. And that's a messing thing. And like, I think users tend to feel very comfortable with like monopolies because it makes their lives very simple.
Right.
I still don't understand why gamers don't want to have two launchers on their PC. Mm. Like,
it's just less convenient. So at least the way that people describe it is like, it's less convenient. You want your stuff on Steam, so you just go to Steam when you want to play a game.
I guess that's the thing that confuses. Maybe it's because I'm a different kind of user. I just go to the start menu on Windows to launch a game.
I don't know.
And then Steam loads up, and I'm like, why is Steam loading up? Oh, right, because I bought this on Steam.
Yeah.
And so I already have a separate launcher. It's called my computer.
Yeah, yeah.
So
That's fair.
So I guess I'm probably the wrong person to make this argument of the convenience of the single launcher.
Can you quickly explain or map out like a two launcher system, what is and why?
Oh, you would just like, it's an application on your computer. So just open it however you want to open it.
So like if you have like I play Fortnite, right?
Yeah.
I don't really play it that much anymore, which is kind of nice. Anyway, in order for me to play Fortnite, I have to open up Epic. So I would just open up the Epic store and then play Fortnite off of that. But most of my games are on Steam, so I will go to Steam if I want to play something else.
Yeah. Oh, as opposed to like it's downloaded. It's like it's just you click on this. I feel so dumb right now.
No.
You're having the same confusion I'm having,
click
I think,
on
which is
it's like if you played with CD-ROMs and you install it and then you have to put the CD in and you click it on the assume that you have the CD in already. Yeah.
Children, that's how it used to work.
On the desktop and it's like, oh yeah, now it's launching.
Yeah, you can do a desktop shortcut for that's the way I launch Steam games is by clicking an icon on my desktop or in the start menu.
It's
like how Minecraft used to work
before
Microsoft bought it.
I'm actually probably unique in that like I just go to the store that I bought it in and then I open it up from there instead of having shortcuts.
I suspect a lot of people do that, which is part of anyway, I guess sort of my larger point about all of this is that kind of environment, that cultural norm is detrimental to the developer experience.
I agree.
Yeah.
Because storefronts like Steam or like the Apple App Store, which is like users don't want to have multiple app stores for things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, I found out about this app on their website. Just give me the link on their website.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
You know, and like discoverability on stores is already pretty miserable. So you know, and there could be certainly why isn't there a website that aggregates the listings of all the app stores? And that's a business model that could then, you know, they could serve ads on that site and then people could browse all the app stores. Like these are worlds we could live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the sort of artificial restrictions of all these platforms ostensibly to make the user experience simpler has a knock-on effect on the other side of that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing is that it is very hard to think of alternatives that do not solve the issue, solve and provide convenience in the same way without falling into the same traps.
Yeah. Too much would have to change. Mm-hmm. And I think our imaginations stop at a certain point.
Yes.
And if we just go one or two step further, we realize, oh, we could have these things, mm-hmm. but so much more would have to change.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to imagine.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of little examples of how these things control our lives. So, like, one of the things that has been under my skin kind of lately is the amount of attention, the oxygen that the Steam Deck gets.
Yeah.
And people who have a Steam Deck love it, mm-hmm. right? And one of the things about a Steam Deck that is great for users and ostensibly great for developers is that Proton, the layer on Linux that lets you run Windows games,
yeah.
there's two things that have resulted in that. One, people don't need to make Linux versions anymore mm-hmm. to serve Linux users. So fewer Linux versions get made now, which is kind of weird, actually.
Yeah.
You know, if for a user, like, they can just download the Windows version, it runs just as well.
Hmm.
So a developer has not a lot of incentive to develop or test on Linux.
Yeah.
But the other half of that is that you're not shipping a Linux version, so you're not supporting Linux.
Right.
But on Steam, everyone wants that Deck Verified label, because if a thing, every game on Steam has a little section in the corner that says, is this game Deck Verified?
Yeah.
Like, to me, that feels insane to me. Because, like, you know, a game we released in 2019 before the Steam Deck came out
right.
has a little sticker on the game page that says, this is not Deck Verified.
Oh, wow.
Like, how are they allowed to do that?
Yeah.
Like, that is wild to me. And that game has a Linux version.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would run natively on a Steam Deck. It doesn't go through their little program, you know. Yeah. Now, there's nothing wrong with the Deck Verified program. It lets people who own it understand that, like, that the icons are the right size for a portable screen, that it's fully controller compatible. These are all good things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Steam leverages that in a way that makes that, even for people who don't own a Steam Deck, it lets these developers are doing all the things they're supposed to do. And these developers aren't doing all the things they're supposed to do. It provides a culture.
Yeah.
Considering how few people own a Steam Deck.
Yeah.
Like, people talk about it like it launched a category. It's so popular. The Wii U, at this point in its life cycle, the most failingest console in history, had four times as much sales as the Steam Deck does at this point in its life cycle.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think people understand that. But because when you go to Steam, the whole store is just draped in mentions of the Steam Deck.
Yeah.
And that's because Steam is a monopoly. They can leverage their success in one area to push another unrelated business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the definition of anti-competitive, which is very frustrating.
Yes.
But what that means is, for me, who just shipped a Windows game that is Deck Verified, mm-hmm. because we went through the Deck Verified program, but they didn't check to see if it would run good on Linux.
Yeah.
Because Proton is very good. They checked to see if it would run good on an 8-inch screen. And so when a user says, hey, I have a problem with video playback or it's crashing, I don't know what to tell them.
Yeah.
I didn't test it on a Steam Deck. I didn't ship a Linux version. Mm. I'm not supporting it. And the thing is, almost all of our bug reports are from Steam Deck users.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, because it's going through this compatibility later. Of course, there's going to be problems.
Mm.
Linux has lots of control configuration options, so users can get into their own trouble. Or it could be that there's a bug in there that just doesn't show up on Windows, but is a legitimate thing that could be fixed.
Yeah.
But again, so it is interesting just to see some players look at this and like, this is a huge problem. And one, the audience is just not very big.
Yeah.
And two, it's not something that's technically officially supported.
Right.
But I'm not going to argue with these players. Like, they're having an unoptimal experience, and that's not their fault.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be technically their fault in the way they're configuring their Steam Deck.
Yeah, sure.
In fact, it almost certainly is. But, like, I'm not going to blame them for that. Like, it's their thing. They can do what they want with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know, you know, and Steam told them this game it works good on it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell them that.
Yeah.
You know, Steam told them that. And I, you know, we submitted to the thing because if we didn't, we'd have this badge on the page that says not supported. And then that would affect how it's viewed by other people.
Right.
It's so complicated
in
terms of the incentives. And in order to just survive in this, you have to basically acquiesce to the whims of these platform holders.
Yeah.
And it creates a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And so I'm frustrated at Steam as a platform for a lot of reasons, but that one is happening to me right now.
Right, yeah.
So it's particularly frustrating. And Steam just announced a bunch of new hardware And one of the things in that announcement was, oh, and we're going to expand the verified program so that it's verified with the new Steam machine and the new VR headset they're doing. And it's like, great, another badge on one of my, on an old game that says it's not compatible.
Yeah.
Like that for people to look at and be like, well, the developer didn't care enough. So.
Yeah. And that's not fair because our, you know, Widget Satchel's been out for 6 years.
Yeah. And it runs great on Linux. Mm-hmm. Like it has a native Linux version.
Yeah.
And so do I have to, should we go back and submit it to the deck? It's a very console style game. It would pass no problem.
That's actually, I mean, this is an extension of that and maybe it's a little too far in the weeds, but I think part of the thing that like, you know, a game that like hasn't been updated in several years, but still works just fine, like Widget Satchel. People will look at that and be like, "Oh, well, it hasn't updated in a while, so like, or should I even play this? Should I even bother?"
Yeah.
Well, I was also
Developers will do tiny, tiny updates every couple of years just so that gamers think it's a real game.
Yeah.
I was also kind of wondering. I think this is out of scope of the conversation, but in the sense of if you're releasing something on the cusp of a generation for platforms, there's that idea of well. Is it going to be compatible with what's next? Or is what you're making for the platform that is next backwards compatible?
So that's actually an interesting point because that happened just now with the Switch, the Switch 2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Switch 2 developer kits are not being distributed to indie developers right now.
I remember you were trying to get one.
I was desperate for one, but there was nothing I could do to get one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard.
I was, you know, I had a couple publisher contacts, but like that amounted to nothing.
Yeah.
Fly to Japan, heist time.
Yeah. It's very invite only at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know, the first Switch, we didn't get access to one for almost a year after it came out, which is actually pretty early for indie developers. Yeah. So it hasn't been that long. So like but because the Switch 2 operating system is essentially identical to the Switch 1, like I think it even the SDK is identical in fact.
Yeah.
It is unusual how long they're waiting on this. But part of that is like, who cares? Your game will work on Switch 2. But here's the thing. When I was developing the Switch 2 or the Switch version of Blippo, I couldn't test it on a Switch 2.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Even after it came out. Nintendo does a little quick check to make sure it won't break.
Yeah.
And then they'll just note that if it's not technically compatible, it won't be in the store for Switch 2, which is like seems totally fair to me. But it's a similar kind of thing where you know, a gamer's looking at right now, they're like, I'm going to buy a Switch 2 next year.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a game. Well, there's no Switch 2 version of this, or what does it work on Switch 2? So I guess I'll hold off on that game, even if it doesn't affect them now. So like those, this all very.
That adds up.
Yeah, it really
does. The kinds of things that like you're looking at them and you're like, I mean, I've done this, right? Like you look at it and you're like, I guess it's not coming out on Switch 2. So like, and I have a Switch 2. I want all my stuff on Switch 2 now. I don't want to play on my Switch anymore. Yeah. So like, I guess
or
I'm gonna get this thing.
You can buy a Switch game on your Switch 2 and it'll work, but it's not the Switch 2 edition.
Yeah. So it doesn't feel like it's a new game. And so it feels like you're like doing backwards compatibility kind of stuff.
I mean, a game like Hades, which was going to sell great no matter what, has a Nintendo Switch 2 edition, probably sold better on Switch, even the first one, because of that label.
Yeah.
I feel so lost. This is so foreign to how I think about games.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
I mean, I think that's part of it too, is like, because there's certain ways that people view games that change how you even approach buying certain things.
Yeah, it's an undercurrent of like consumer sentiment.
Yeah,
that we don't think about a lot because I think gamers in particular really feel like they're the masters of their own domain, and like not swayed by this or that.
Yeah,
and you know, I think we are unwilling to realize how directed we are by platforms in a way that if we had to choose. We would make different choices, both as consumers and certainly as developers, where it's just much more obvious as developers to know that you're being pushed around a little bit to do certain things.
That's
now, there's nothing wrong with developers having or platforms having standards or them making choices that if you want to be part of their platform, you need to be on board.
Yeah.
I think that's like perfectly fine. In fact, it should work that way.
Yes.
The you know, the idea that like a store should have no limits on what it sells, for example. I don't think that's correct.
Yeah.
And
but if they're the only store on the planet, effectively, then they have a higher obligation to be more inclusive or at least more deliberate about what they don't allow on their store because they are the gateway to the world.
I do also think that the distinction between functional and good experience, having those be very clearly two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And being able, I mean, I think you're arguing that the messaging around that is definitely meant to sway in Steam's instance, but it is very important. And the nuance between the two of like, hey, this works, but it may not, but it may be difficult to read, or this is, it works, but it's not going to be fun. You know, there's the difference between those things. And I think like that's,
and that
is also important, and that also leads credence to having certain kinds of standards.
Yeah.
Yes. But those labels need to be fundamentally honest.
Exactly. Yes.
And they need to be rigorous. They shouldn't be, and they almost always are, tied up with some commercial interest.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is, when you're a developer, you can see through a lot of that stuff in a way that frustrates you because you have no power to change.
Well, so Steam also has a little label that tells you whether or not this thing is playable on a controller or not, because I'm a controller player.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's not always accurate. Sometimes you could play games that this it says you can't on controller and things, and vice versa.
Right.
That is more utilitarian. Like,
yes.
It's beneficial because, like, if you are like me and you like playing things on a controller, if this game doesn't have controller support, you know,
there's also like almost no implication to that. Like,
yeah, you can,
if it can't work on a controller and a player wants to play this game on a controller and it's the type of game that normally would, that's really useful information.
Yes.
If it's a game that's not controller friendly, and so mouse and keyboard is just the only way it was designed to work, then that label of no controller support doesn't imply anything wrong.
Yes.
In a way that a lot of their sort of the newer stuff that they've been implementing does sort of.
Yeah, right. I think some of it is, I think it's because it's, the Steam Deck is trying to be so many, it is so many things at once that it, it unfairly blends all of those things into verified or not.
Yeah.
You know, because is it actually possible in the sense that you can play it and then not have to like touch the screen in order to unstick yourself from a certain corner? That's one thing. Is it fully playable in the sense that you can manipulate everything and it totally works fine, but the text is really, really small and therefore it would be a lot harder to play? That's another thing. But there is no one term that describes those two experiences concisely.
Well, and
it's verified versus not.
The trick, though, is that would make a ton of sense if Steam were the Steam Deck store.
Yes.
But it's not. It's the PC game store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's the PC game store.
Right.
So, like, those distinctions are really important to users.
Yeah.
But they're important to Steam Deck users.
And they could display that information for Steam Deck.
For Steam Deck users.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't think they should be displaying that unless you own a Steam Deck.
Right.
And frankly, it frustrates me that that Steam does hardware and operates a store.
Yeah, I guess
that's not exclusive. Right? If they sold the Steam Deck and then the store was only on the Steam Deck, like how consoles work, then I think that they should actually really go crazy with that kind of integration. Sure. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But because it's not the case, and they always talk a lot about how they have an open platform, then why does every game page talk about whether it's compatible with the hardware they sell?
Yeah,
like it seems so natural, but it's actually completely insane.
I have said I like my Steam Deck.
It's everyone likes their Steam Deck. Like it's a good product.
But like what I'm specifically trying to do for not necessarily you, Mark, but for listeners is like highlighting the things that like, okay, yeah, this does make sense for hardware. Hopefully, to then help emphasize what Mark has said of like, and the fact that it's so prevalent feels weird and ulterior motive-y and definitely has marketing wrapped up within it.
Yeah.
In the way that it's like the messaging itself is helpful, can be helpful and useful.
Yeah.
It makes sense. But the prevalence and the way it is being conveyed is bleh.
It has other effects.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And those effects
that's
are
what
unrelated,
I'm kind of trying to do, I guess.
Yeah. A developer doesn't really have the option to opt out of a world where a player is going to look at your game and wonder if it's compatible. You can't just, like, you're not in a position to be able to choose a life without that consideration.
Yeah.
Right? Which is very frustrating.
Yeah.
You sort of have to do it. In fact, that was a big conversation with Blippo, we have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how true that was, actually. Well, how much, you know, it just felt true because we live in a culture, we've been already ingrained where that's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's my complaint about like sort of the monopolistic aspects of those unrelated businesses being tied together. But a simpler example is how Steam organizes and marks games that are on sale.
Oh, sure.
A big thing about, and people know this about the culture of Steam, is people just don't buy anything unless it's on sale.
Yeah.
They almost don't care how much it's on sale for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And having seen sales numbers for multiple games that, you know, it's kind of crazy how you can have a game that has a good price, and then you can put it on sale for 10% off, and it will like quadruple in sales.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And it's like that's pretty wild to me. That like that's so now you have a lot of data analytics about like how often do you do sales, how long should it be. It's this whole thing that most independent developers don't have the capacity to understand or know that, get that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of publishers do, and it becomes very root and routine, but it requires a lot of understanding of like, how do I calculate it so that the game is on sale? Not too often, but often enough. I can't put it on sale for too low because that will go on the permanent record and then I'll never be able to put it on sale for less than that.
Yeah. But then also like, how high do you price your original game? So that way, if you put it on sale, however many times, you still make profit, but also right. it's not so high that someone wouldn't go, oh, I don't want to put that on my wish list. It's too expensive.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. And all of that is just, that's the, I don't think we need to live in that world either, mm-hmm. but like Steam has definitely put us in that world. And it's yeah. one of those things about that, Stephen, yeah. you were talking about before we started the show,
yeah.
which is discoverability
right.
on console platforms mm-hmm. is, I think users would describe it as much, much worse.
Yeah, yeah. The difficult thing about like if you're on Switch and try to find a game on there, a lot of the games that are showing up are just new games that just came out.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that are priority. And so like a lot of developers are encouraged to put as much crap basically on the surface, so
multiple at bats basically
yeah. so that there's that their games get seen and then they can make yeah. some money off of that.
And Steam has the exact opposite problem,
yes.
where in order to get any visibility at all, you have to be like a data analytics master
yeah.
to like work the system,
right?
Because it's so and players are so ingrained to this culture of min-maxing their pocketbook,
yeah.
They're unwilling to risk an extra dollar on a game that they might like.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that culture is very harmful.
And I mean, some of that is just the economy. Like it's rough right now.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but like
all games are optional purchases.
Yeah.
And so, it's kind of interesting how people talk about like what value it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's all gravy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, also, that does also tie into platforms because,
yeah.
you know, platforms will have certain, you know, power, certain catalogs, and you know, certain longevity, and is an entry cost.
Yeah,
like yep. There's so many games that I wouldn't be able to play if I didn't have the Steam Deck because my computer is just not powerful enough.
Sure.
And you know, there's also that sense of like, okay, well, if things are sunsetting, you know, am I going to have to commit to getting a new console? And how new do I get one? You know, I have a mm-hmm. PS4. At some point, we got it in 2020. At some point, I'm going to have to get a PS something else. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do they have anything other than 5, or is 5 my next one? It's going to be used, whatever it is.
5 is the
whatever one. I can play the newest Persona game
yeah,
on, whenever
yeah,
that
yeah.
comes out.
Yeah. It's it's kind of frustrating, like the way that things are set up, that like you feel stuck. If you want other options, there aren't any.
Yeah.
I feel that way on Windows. Like they sunset Windows 10.
Yeah.
And they're not doing any more support for that. And I had a difficult time trying to figure out how to get my main PC to upgrade to 11 because there's something you have to do
yeah.
in the BIOS or something. And I tried doing it once and I was like, I can't figure this out. and I tried doing that a few years ago and I don't want to learn it now.
Yeah.
But now like the Street Fighter 6 just had announced like a couple weeks ago that like they're going to eventually not have any more support for Windows 10. And it just sucks because like, there's still 40% yeah. of Windows users,
yeah.
as far as I understand it, are still using Windows 10.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's like, that's 40% of your audience.
I remember so many times as a kid, like I wanted to lend my computer games to other people and they had Macs, which
yeah.
they couldn't play the games that yeah. I had. And like that was the barrier to entry, is like, oh, I don't have a Windows computer.
Yeah, yeah. I think, I mean, these are all how platforms impact our lives as consumers. But I think in both of those examples,
yeah.
like it's not the platforms that are guiding developer behavior.
No.
Right? Like, Windows isn't stopping you from shipping things compatible with Windows 10.
Sure, but I mean,
encouraging people to stop.
Because Windows decided to stop support for 10, like Street Fighter 6 decided to stop support for 10 as well.
Sure.
And so like...
Yeah, I mean, it's very chicken and egg
yeah.
in terms of like, are you looking at your game catalog as a player for platform first or game first? Mm. You know, how do you make your decisions? Where do you start? But then also with developers, there's a sense of, well, what are we obligated to support because it will help our game, versus what are we going to put our game on because of scope and time and longevity of the
yeah,
thing?
Right.
Well, that goes back to the sort of the Apple example at the very beginning, which is if you're doing mobile games, and Android's like this as well now, at least the sort of Google flavor of it, which is the version most people use, is you have to not just ship a game, you have to commit to maintain it for kind of ever.
Yeah.
Because there's always, every couple of years, there's something that changes and means you have to submit an update.
Right.
Yep.
And if you don't, it gets taken out of the stores.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard to be a developer just making a game, releasing it, and then moving on to your next game.
Yeah.
In order to be a mobile developer, you have to have a different business model.
Yes.
And that also very much encourages things like free-to-play games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that those are successful because they have lots of easy, low friction buy-in for users.
Right.
You can do user acquisition. And because they're going to be ongoing experiences, you will just always be updating it anyway.
Yep.
So those things don't bother you.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to release, just a regular old indie game on mobile, then you have to do all these extra things that are not part of your intended plan.
Yeah.
Because there's a rolling compatibility.
And then you have to allocate someone in a back room to constantly be on call for if you have to update something or something breaks for the
mobile. That's different from consoles. Consoles are actually quite good about this, where if you ship a version for a console, there is rolling compatibility for SDKs. Mm-hmm. And so in the middle of development, you might have to update your SDK as you go before you release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But once you release, then all the major console platforms will always ensure compatibility with your game, even as it the system updates for users. And that is something that's a really great, that's very developer friendly, because it's because that's an environment where you'll release a single player game and move on to your next thing.
Right.
And it's an interest to the platform.
Yeah.
But on a mobile platform, they're interested in every in-app purchase nets Google or Apple 30%. So they want to encourage games to do that business model. And one way to do that is to encourage the types of games that that developers will continue to maintain.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's nefarious exactly, but it's all these incentives sort of aligning. Hmm. And then they do more and more that align with those incentives.
It feels scummy either way.
After a while, you just realize that there's just things you can't do.
Right. Yeah, there's having things align, and then there's pressing.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, this isn't a world that we can have like a Monument Valley anymore.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Right. And like, it's every time and again that you'll see these like attachments for mobile that will add joysticks and buttons and stuff. And like, one of the reasons, other than being sort of bulky and silly, one of the reasons those aren't very popular is because games that are traditional like Game Boy style action games aren't popular on mobile, not because there aren't buttons, but because of all those business model things.
Yeah.
Like, we could live in a world where, like Monument Valley and tons of like indie platformers could be on mobile.
Sure.
And then, but we just don't live in that world. And so there are other things that can't be made or aren't successful because of what's allowed, and that it's very much driven by the platforms and ecosystems that control these systems.
Yeah.
And you don't realize that. You look at a thing and you're like, oh, I want to make something for that. And then you're aligned with those incentives.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start doing that, and then maybe things change.
Yeah.
That happened to a lot of mobile developers around 2012.
Yeah.
They made businesses out of mobile development, and then suddenly things changed, and so quickly.
Yeah.
And suddenly they didn't have the skills for that new world.
Yeah.
They needed a marketing budget to do user acquisition. Like, half their budget was getting players instead of making the game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Totally changed everything. And there's nothing they could do about it. And they all pivoted, and they make different things these days.
Yep. Yeah.
Sad story.
And on that note, that uplifting note.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week is our nicest of 2025, the last episode of the year before hiatus. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.